It is a rare, rare Jobs Day Friday in this economy when the jobs report is not the big, big news. But that is where we find ourselves today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 4th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. To be clear, this morning's jobs report matters, and more on it coming later in the program. But honestly, there is a good case to be made, which we are about to do, that there is a bunch of other stuff that happened this week that matters more. Samaya Keynes is at The Economist. Anna Swanson is with The New York Times. Hey, everybody.
Hey. Hey, Kai.
So my theory of my case, is that this is a trade-driven week in this economy. And Anna, I want to take it roughly chronologically. On Tuesday, this report from the Institute of Supply Management about American manufacturing, it is contracting in large part because of the trade war on exports. Discuss.
I think that's right. So the administration continues to blame the Federal Reserve and the strong dollar for any economic slowdown. And there are other things going on globally. There's been a credit slowdown in China, for example. But it is pretty clear that the trade war is taking a toll economically. And I think that's definitely true in terms of uncertainty for businesses and manufacturing and potentially bleeding over into consumer confidence and the service sector as well. And meanwhile, you have the United States poised to kind of double down on this trade strategy. So the U.S. announced that it would go ahead with tariffs on $7.5 billion dollars of European products this week. And then there are further tariff increases on China scheduled for later this month and then also in December.
You just took my whole list of things, man. Now I got like 4 minutes to kill with nothing to talk about.
No, I thought I was giving you a segue.
You were. That's right. So Samaya Keynes, I'm going to go to you, actually, and talk about this World Trade Organization ruling on Wednesday that said the United States is authorized under the rules of international trade to levy tariffs on $7.5 billion worth of European imports because of subsidies that the Europeans have given to Airbus for damage to counteract damage done to Boeing. This is the way international trade is supposed to work, first of all, right? There are rules.
Yes, there are rules. And this is a super different example of tariffs to the rest of the tariffs that we've seen in the Trump administration. If you think about his tariffs on steel, his tariffs on China, that's really the U.S. going it alone, saying, I don't like what you're doing and I'm going to put tariffs on you. This is completely different. This is the rules-based system. You've got these judges who've said, look, we've compared the policy with the rules as they're written. And we say, look, America, you are allowed to put these tariffs on the Europeans. And the point is that by doing these things within the system, it's much less likely to lead to escalation, right? The Europeans are much less likely to hit back. You're much less likely to get the kind of trade war that we've seen with China and also the retaliation that we saw when we had the tariffs on steel.
What are we supposed to do then, Anna, when I'm going to pick one. Parmesan cheese consumers in this country are going to have to pay 25% more because Airbus got a bunch of subsidies. How does that calm things down? Or I guess, what are the bigger ramifications, right?
Yeah, so the United States does have the express permission of the WTO here, but these tariffs are still going to weigh on consumers. And in particular, it seems like people throwing fancy dinner parties. It's
well,
25%
right.
tariff
right.
on,
right.
like us, I'm sure, 25% tariff on French wine, Spanish olives, German coffee, Parmesan, Scotch whiskey, and then also a 10% tariff on aircraft. So I think there's a lot for, you know, consumers still to complain about, to say that you know, these tariffs might be within the rules, but they still weigh on consumers and the economy. And there's another case that the United States and Europe should be working together to write new rules surrounding subsidies, which is what this case is over and is a main problem with China, instead of hitting each other with tariffs.
Can I just jump in and say that I, you know, as with any other lover of European cheese, I'm very concerned. But just looking at the numbers, and we don't have the kind of final list of what exactly is going to be hit. But it looks like the biggest ticket item, as Anna mentioned, was aircraft. Putting this into economic context, obviously everyone thinks of Parmesan and gets very anxious, as I do. But economically, it's probably the aircraft that it's going to cause the biggest sting.
Well, and also, though, I mean, $7.5 billion in a, what are we, like a $19 trillion economy really is nothing. It's more the principle of the thing, right, Anna?
Yeah, I think it's an irritant. But you have other, you know, issues at play in the U.S.-EU relationship as well. And as Samaya was saying, an action taken within global trading rules means it's less likely to escalate. But there's a lot of other stuff going on between the U.S. and Europe also, the potential for car tariffs later this year. So, you know, it is something that can kind of aggravate tension.
I was actually feeling kind of optimistic on this.
I thought,
oh, well, if you're giving Trump his tariffs, look, he's able to put tariffs on French wine, maybe he'll be less interested. Maybe he'll be persuaded that, oh, we've already got tariffs on the Europeans, and so he doesn't need to go and put tariffs on cars. Maybe
that's
over-optimistic.
That itch.
Maybe. I don't know.
Give me something. One never knows with this administration and trade policy. Samay Keynes at The Economist, Anna Swanson at The New York Times. Thanks, you two. Have a nice weekend.
Thanks.
All right, we'll see you on Wall Street on this Friday. Here is one way to think about it. Wasn't nothing in this morning's jobs report that's going to stay Jay Powell and the Fed from another rate cut when they meet the end of this month. And you do know how Wall Street loves its rate cuts, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So I gave jobs a mere nod up at the beginning of the program because I knew we were going to get to them eventually, and here we are. The September unemployment report that came out this morning, 136,000 new jobs, 3.5% on the unemployment rate, both of which are good to, you know, pretty impressive, actually, for as long as this expansion has been going on. In the maybe not so great category was wage growth. There basically wasn't any last month. Paychecks are up just under 3% since last September, the slowest that growth has been in more than a year, by the way. So we sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to find out what that means for people in their economic day-to-day.
Carly Johnston and her husband have been pretty happy with how their paychecks have been growing until now. She's 40, a lawyer. He's in computers. They both work for Fortune 500 companies near Minneapolis. Last year, her husband got a promotion and a big raise, but
this year, his boss told him no raise at all because of what's happening in terms of tariffs and everything else. It's affecting their business.
Her company's also struggling, and she thinks she won't get a raise this year either. Stan DeWitt is used to not getting a raise. He's 56 and works as a music director at a nonprofit in Long Beach, California. His pay hasn't gone up since 2014, but health insurance premiums keep going up 12% a year.
The lack of a cost of living adjustment means that it's just getting harder and harder to hang on, let alone getting ahead.
It can be hard to keep up even with decent pay hikes. Victor Ponce is 43 and works in IT security for Los Angeles County. He got a 2.5% raise this month and will get another 1% in January under a union contract.
Now, we live in LA, it's never enough. But at least it's something that helps.
Brian Mayfield is 35 and works in the renewable energy industry in Bend, Oregon. He's gotten a few promotions over the last 5 years and doubled his salary to about $80,000. This year,
the review process was great. So all the stars aligned. I was really excited. Kind of like picking out the next toy, you know, imagining what this raise might be.
And he got 3.1%. In an economy with lots of openings and low unemployment, the best way to get a big raise is often to get a new job. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
One of the reasons the unemployment rate is so low, because 3.5% is crazy low, is that people are piling back into the workforce. In September, just a hair more than 80% of Americans 25 to 54 were working. That's the biggest chunk of that group since 2007. Marketplace's Erica Barris has more on that one.
The growing number of Americans in the workforce is being driven disproportionately by women. In September, their participation rate rose to 74%, the highest since 2001. Topeka Chibber is program director of the California nonprofit Women Back to Work. She says it's tough for women who've left the workforce to return.
Because of the unconscious bias that's there, it is there towards somebody who's taken a break. So one has to be determined and focused in order to get back into the workforce.
Chibber knows that from experience. She left a career in marketing in 2012 so she could be with her two kids full time. Then after 5 years,
you know, I updated my resume, I updated my LinkedIn profile, and I started applying to jobs online. I did not hear back even from one company.
It took her a year to eventually find the job she has now. In April, Daniel Klin of Hartford, Connecticut, was laid off from his job as a physician's assistant, specializing in ophthalmology. He sent out about 75 resumes and only got a few calls back. It took him 6 months to find a job. He starts next week. So Klin says when he hears about the tight labor market,
I think for certain fields, yeah, you can go in and dictate your own salary and have people fall all over you.
That's what happened to Wesley Hammes of Glenview, Illinois. He never left the workforce when he decided to switch aerospace engineering jobs late last year. The recruiters came to him.
It was pretty similar with all the different job offers. You know, they were struggling to find people, and so there were a lot of perks.
The only catch? He had to move away from Cincinnati, where he'd been working for years. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
One more quick thing on jobs from yesterday's program. This one is, we did an explainer on how the Bureau of Labor Statistics gets the employment data that it crunches and then publishes on the first Friday of every month, as it did this morning. I misidentified economist Tara Sinclair. She's at GW, George Washington University, not the other one with George in the name across town. Deep into Medicare we go now, because this week President Trump signed an order expanding benefits in private Medicare plans. About a third of the 60 or so million elderly and disabled Americans on Medicare have joined what are called Advantage plans. They're run by private insurers like UnitedHealth and Aetna. For consumers, there are now more data points to consider when deciding what kind of Medicare is best for them. It's a pretty complicated system to navigate in the first place, it should be said. But as Marketplace's Jack Stewart reports, where there is choice like that, there is also business opportunity.
Medicare, Medicare Advantage, Medigap, Parts A, B, C, D. There are a lot of decisions to make when you become eligible at 65, as this TV commercial from insurer Humana plays on.
There are lots of people who are confused about which Medicare plan is right for them.
Hey, that's me. I barely know where to start.
Lindsay Wiley directs the Health Law and Policy Program at American University. She says when it comes to the Advantage plans, things get really complicated.
There's a lot of apples to oranges comparison that happens because they have different packages of services, different combinations of co-payments, co-insurance, deductibles.
There are plenty of people poised to guide you through it, though, like Danielle Roberts, co-founder of Boomer Benefits. It's an insurance broker, but she says her agents actually end up doing a ton of education, like webinars, because people are overwhelmed by the choices.
When someone has a need, we can search through the variety of different carriers and see if we can find one that has a competitive premium or that's a close match for the benefits that the client is wanting.
Her company and the countless other brokers out there are paid a commission by the insurer. Another big player in this field, AARP, works a little differently. It partnered with UnitedHealthcare to offer co-branded health plans. If you're of a certain age, you're no doubt getting deluged with mailers and phone calls from health insurance companies. Jerry Kaminsky is at the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research. He says Advantage plans might limit you to a smaller network of providers, but they usually come with something extra.
One of the big drawing features or attractions of Medicare Advantage plans is that they offer benefits in addition to the standard Medicare coverage.
That includes things like hearing aid coverage or even gym memberships. It's all a lot of decisions to make, and open enrollment starts October 15th. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And I really wanted a martini, and martinis and oysters are best friends.
It's Friday. Happy hour prices, gang. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow Industrial is up 372 points today, 1.4%, 26,573. The NASDAQ banked 110 points, It's about 1.4%, 79.82. The S&P 500 up 41 points, also 1.4%, 29.52 there. For the week, though, a little rougher with all that bad data we were talking about with Anna and Sumai Keynes. The Dow lost 0.9%, the NASDAQ gained 0.4%, and the S&P 500 down 0.3% week on week. Unemployment is at a 50-year low. Doesn't mean some companies aren't still shedding jobs. One of them, HP, was one of the big losers on Wall Street. Stocks swooned nearly 10% after the printer company announced it's cutting its workforce. A report that Apple is boosting production of its new iPhone 11 to meet demand sent its shares up 2.8%. The business communications company Avia Holdings surged today up 30%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable, a new podcast from Marketplace that explores the thing we're always in our feelings over but don't really know how to talk about: money. This is a storytelling podcast that digs into things like how someone can feel like an imposter when they move from one socioeconomic class to another, or why so many people lie about what's in their bank account. We'll even teach you how to ask everyone you know about how much they make. But just to be clear, this is not a personal finance podcast. It is a podcast about life and how money messes with it. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Food is where we go now. Food, how we get it, specifically something called ag tech, agriculture technology, obviously. You want to grow crops, you need sun, soil, and water. And here in California, the agriculture-rich Central Valley, to be specific, we got sun, we got soil, the water is the hard part. So farmers are figuratively taken to the skies. Lauren Smiley wrote about it for the New York Times. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
For those who haven't seen it, describe for me, would you, the Central Valley of California, what it looks like?
So I drove out from San Francisco a couple weekends ago to Yosemite. And on the way, you go through the Central Valley. And one thing that will strike you is this is not a landscape that comes on in stages. There's literally a line where there's the first row of crops. And that is because the whole region is run on irrigation, and it's just where they've decided to start irrigating the first row of crops is where the valley begins.
And that is the sort of premise of the technology that now these farmers are using to get every last drop where they want it to be. Specifically now for your piece, aerial imagery. Describe for me how it works and what they're doing.
There's this new trend in agriculture called precision agriculture. You use just enough water, pesticide, and fertilizer that a single crop needs to have maximum yields and no more. And so I was looking at these aerial imaging companies. They fly actual fixed-wing planes over fields with this fancy imaging machinery. They're capturing these wavelengths of the light that's being reflected off the crops. And all of these things are, all of this data is then sent through these algorithms to come up with a water stress index that shows, okay, that line over there needs more water. That area over there needs more fertilizer.
So if I'm a farmer out there in my pickup truck, I'm not necessarily going out and you know, feeling the dirt with my hands, right? I'm with a tablet or a smartphone, and I'm just looking at the data to see what this data is telling me about how my trees are doing.
Exactly. They can get their data like the next day after these flights, like usually within one day, and it will show them basically real-time information, you know, at a level that your naked eye could never see. And I mean, one thing I learned when doing this story is that it's still a very analog industry, and that there is just a lot of walking the lines, seeing where you have leaks on your irrigation lines. There's nothing that gives you this intelligence about your field like these aerial images.
And the bigger picture here, if you'll pardon the aerial imagery pun, right? The bigger picture is not just the central is not just the Central Valley, but it's agriculture worldwide having to produce more food for more people in a warming climate with more scarce water, right?
That is right. And the Central Valley is very much a microcosm of the worldwide problem here, and that we've had, you know, droughts over the last few years. And I read actually this UN study while I was doing this story, and it was kind of one of those statistics that makes you gulp, but it was like by 2050, the world's growers need to produce 70% more food on just 5% more land, and technology is widely recognized as the force that will get them there.
Lauren Smiley, writing in the New York Times about precision agriculture, pictures from the air. Lauren, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's Friday. Maybe you're thinking, if you indulge, that it'd be nice to stop for a quick drink on the way home. I mean, you can't beat happy hour prices, right? Bar and restaurant owners are counting on those special deals to get you in the door. Also, especially in places on the coast, they're counting on oysters. Cheap oysters. Marketplace's Justin Ho has the economics of the dollar oyster happy hour.
There's a seafood spot in Midtown Manhattan called Crave Fish Bar. It serves oysters from the east and west coasts that cost $3 to $4 a piece on the regular menu. But get there during happy hour, and you can order a number of those oysters for $1 or $1.50.
So happy hour tonight, we have, let me just count right here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. We have 11 East Coast oysters tonight, and we have one West Coast.
Ryan Owens is a managing partner at Crave. He says between the restaurant's two locations, they're going through roughly 20,000 oysters a week, 6,000 during happy hour alone. Blair Hurst just finished off a dozen with a work colleague.
Price point is pretty phenomenal, you know. I also would try 50-cent oysters. Actually, I don't know if I would try 50-cent oysters.
At the bar, Diana Purcell and a friend are working on their second dozen and thinking about ordering a third.
We came here specifically for the oysters. So, and I really wanted a martini, and martinis and oysters are best friends.
That's the strategy. The restaurant isn't making much off the oysters. Owen says he buys oysters at around 77 to 80 cents a piece. But the hope is they'll rake it in at the bar, and that people might stay for dinner and order a whole branzino for $36, or the lobster curry for $38. Crave isn't the only restaurant that's figured this out. Four other spots are doing oyster happy hours on the same block.
And everyone from the Irish pub to the Korean barbecue to the, you know, the tavern is all doing dollar oysters now. We were never seeing that 10 years ago.
About 2 miles south of Crave Fish Bar, I'm at another oyster happy hour at a restaurant called Coal and Pistol. With me is oyster enthusiast Julie Chu, who runs an oyster-focused blog called In a Half Shell, with high-def oyster photos and guides to finding good oysters.
I just want to give you like a general around-the-coastline tasting of different salinities and textures and flavors.
Chu says the boom in oyster happy hours is giving people access to a food that used to be pretty pricey. But she says all of those cheap oysters have also created a distortion.
Which was people believed oysters would be cheap, and what they were getting was very normal, or good, perhaps.
Chu likes places like Coal and Pistol, which specializes in seafood and serves lots of oysters every day. But at other spots, she says shuckers might not be properly trained, and the staff may be less experienced in handling and storing raw seafood.
You see oysters that look like just dried up pieces of snot sitting in a shell. It sounds disgusting, but I've seen it happen where the oyster is not alive. It's just a dead, sad little thing in a shell, and it still gets served.
And eaten. But it's costly to produce high-quality oysters, says Pete Malinowski, who grew up on an oyster farm off of Long Island, which sells a lot of oysters to restaurants in New York City.
It's incredibly labor-intensive because you have to handle those cages all the time. You're sorting the oysters by size. You're getting rid of other animals that sat on the cages. And it's anywhere from 18 months to 4 years to go from a 2-millimeter oyster to a market-size oyster.
There is an upside to the popularity of oyster happy hours. Malinowski and I are talking on Governor's Island in New York, where he runs the Billion Oyster Project. 75 restaurants around the city give the Billion Oyster Project their empty shells, which the project uses to grow new oysters in New York Harbor.
We collect about 8,000 pounds of shell per week, and that's very seasonally. So it's as much as 10,000 pounds sometimes a year.
These New York Harbor oysters aren't for eating. Oysters filter water, and the idea is that if the project eventually grows a billion of them, the harbor could filter itself every 3 days. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out, in which I am thankful my kids have decided it's not cool to listen to this program anymore. From the New York Times today, this item, a survey from the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants about allowances for kids. 2/3 of parents give their children an allowance. So, yes, same in my house, although we are a bit in arrears, to be honest. But here's the kicker. The average amount weekly for allowances is $30, which seems like a lot. Also, it's way up from the survey done in 2016 when the weekly average was $17 for kids for a week. Or am I just cheap? All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial is up 372 points today, 1.4%. The NASDAQ banked 110 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 up 41 points. Also, what do you think? Yes, 1.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager around these parts. I'm Kai Rizzo. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.